This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
And professor of religion and American studies and ethnicity at the University of Southern California. He is the co-founder of the American Learning Institute for Muslims, otherwise known as ALIM, as well as past president of Sharia Scholar Association of North America. He is the author of a plethora of books and has written a number of thought-provoking articles. Please welcome Dr. Jackson.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله نستعينه ونستغفره ونستهديه ونعوذ بالله من شرور أنفسنا ومن سيئات أعمالنا من يهدي الله فلا مضل له ومن يضلل فلا هادي له وأشهد أن لا إله إلا الله وحده لا شريك له وأشهد أن محمدا عبده ورسوله صلى الله عليه وعلى آله وصحبه وسلم رب اشرح لي صدري ويسر أمري واحلل عقدة من لساني يفقه قولي وقني شر نفسي وفلت لساني وان اضل او اضل اؤذل او اذل بغير حق رب العالمين وبعد السلام عليكم ورحمه الله وبركاته. I've been asked to talk on the issue of reform, modernity, and Islam, exploring the fault lines. And part of the description leads me to believe that I'm supposed to be talking about the question of how Islam can sustain its relevance, its efficacy, and its power and strength in the modern world, given the changes that have come about in the modern world. And I'm going to take, in so doing, a tack that is somewhat different from Sheikh Yas's. In fact, I'm glad that he focused on what he focused on, because I'm going to look at not so much reform of the actual tradition of Islam in terms of details, but look at what it is that has placed the Islamic tradition in the tension with modern reality that it has come into. Now, to start off, there are basically two ways to destroy a living organism. The first way is simply to attack it directly, stab it in the heart, kill it. The second way, however, is to attack that organism's ecosystem. Once a living organism's ecosystem has been degraded, has been ravaged, has been destroyed, no amount of tending to the organism itself will be enough to save or rescue that organism permanently. If a river is polluted to the point that it becomes impossible for a fish to live in it, no amount of feeding that fish or injecting it with whatever will be able to sustain that fish on a permanent basis. You have to clean up the ecosystem of the fish or the fish will die. Now, religion differs from living organisms in that religion is not a physical entity like a fish. And so religion does not directly sort of rely on a physical ecosystem. Islam, like Christianity or Judaism, for example, Islam can survive in the Arabian desert as a physical environment just as easily as it can survive in a modern metropolis in the West. Religion is not dependent upon any particular physical ecosystem. But religions do require a certain kind of social-cultural biosphere in order for them to be able to live and to thrive. The sociologist of religion, Peter Berger, he calls this religion's plausibility structure. Religion's plausibility structure. Now, basically, a plausibility structure is the overall socio-cultural context within which a system of meaning, an institution, or a set of beliefs is able to sustain its status as real, valuable, normal, and even true. People who live in this particular social cultural context are not likely to defy or reject the reigning beliefs and institutions that define their social cultural context. Instead, they're more likely to take these things for granted and ultimately accept them as their own. If we take the social political environment, let's say in the United States, for example, the president of the United States is said to be the most powerful individual in the world. And yet, because of the social political ecosystem in which he, or maybe she, don't know, lives, I'm not trying to be political here, can you imagine an American president using the N-word publicly? Can you imagine an American president standing up and saying, I'm an atheist, publicly? Why can't they say that? They can't say that because the social political plausibility structure won't allow for that. They won't be able to survive in that kind of a social political environment. And so what we have to look at in terms of Islam in the modern world is what the relationship between Islam as a religion and the prevailing social culture and the social political environment, what relationship have those two come into? And my contention here is going to be that one of the problems that we have as modern Muslims has to do with our overall understanding of Islam as a religion. And I'm not talking about any particular bab of fiqh or any question of aqidah or anything like that. I'm talking about how we understand Islam as a religious construct. And what I mean by this is the following. There's a Jewish professor at Princeton University. She wrote a book entitled How Judaism Became a Religion. Sounds like a strange title, right? Because we automatically think of Judaism as what? As a religion. She wrote a book entitled How Judaism Became a Religion. And in this book, she writes the following. Prior to modernity, Judaism was not a religion. And Jewishness was not a matter of culture or nationality. Rather, Judaism and Jewishness were all of these at once: religion, culture, and nationality. In other words, Judaism was the whole kit and caboodle, not simply religious beliefs and practices. Now, another way of looking at this, and I believe that this applies to Islam, and this is part of our problem. Islam, traditionally speaking, was not simply a matter of religious beliefs and practices. Islam included beliefs and practices, and also its own plausibility structure. It included those things that would keep it relevant, that would keep it meaningful, that would sustain the value and the efficacy of its teachings. And what happened with modernity, and this is why this author talks about how Judaism became a religion, because what modernity has essentially done is separate religious belief and practice from plausibility structure. Religious belief and practice, religious communities can have that. You can have your prayers, you can have your doctrines, you can have your fasting, Ramadan, etc. But the things that keep those things relevant in the lives of human beings, that plausibility structure, that is now the property of modern society and the modern state. And so religions are left now to try to keep themselves relevant without the ability to unpollute the water that they exist in. This is what we're dealing with in terms of Islam in the modern world. Now, I'm going to tax our cameraman if I can, because I think that it may be easier for me to make this a bit clearer to you visually. If the cameraman can get this right quick. Can anybody see this? You can't see this? I mean on the screen. Huh? What is it? I can't hear you. It's a nine. All right. Okay. This one in the middle, what is this now? Huh? No, what's the middle one? It's a nine. You sure? All right. You sure? All right. What's this middle one now? What is it? Huh? What does that say? It says what? Ego. How do you spell ego with a nine? Now, the point that I'm making here is this. As long as that nine stood alone, it was very clearly a nine, a number. When I added a seven on one side and an eight on another side, that made it what? Even more clearly, a number. Did I do anything to the nine? Your perception of the nine was totally determined by what surrounded the nine, by its environment. And when I changed the environment to that, the nine was no longer recognizable as a nine. And what we have to understand is that modernity has placed certain things in the social cultural ecosystem that makes it very difficult to recognize the value of religion for what it is, including Islam. And what we have to understand is this. I don't care how much. Is that any clearer, a nine now? Is it? What does that say? Wait a minute, how is it more clearly a nine than if it still says ego? My point to you is this. We will not make the nine clearer by simply focusing on the nine. If we want to make the nine clearer, we have to do what? We have to focus on the plausibility structure that surrounds the nine. And until we are able to do that, we are likely to have difficulty recognizing the nine for what it actually is. If that nine is Islam, we have to understand that we will not be able to restore Islam to its proper place by simply doubling down and tripling down on the religious sciences per se. We're not going to be able to do it. We have to get back to an understanding of Islam that says Islam is not only religious beliefs and practices, but it also includes its own plausibility structure. And that means that it is not simply and has never been simply religious scholars who maintain and sustain the relevance, the efficacy, and the power of Islam in the world. You out there, you know, I've always wondered something. I hope you'll indulge me for a moment here. Maybe some of you can give me an answer. Because I've always wondered this. I mean, you take somebody like Abu Nawas, Abu Nawas was an Arab poet in the Abbasid period. And the guy, how can I put this, and still be rated PG? The guy, I mean, he had poems on wine drinking. The guy loved wine. Allah fasqini khamran wa qul hiya al-khamr wa la tatasattari idha amkana al-jahr. I mean, pour me some wine and say it's wine. And don't hide if you're able to do it in public. The guy liked boys. It was known about him. The guy was involved in all kinds of activities. And I asked myself, why did Abu Nawas not just leave Islam? Does that question make sense to you? Why didn't he just leave? Someone who had those proclivities today would be more likely to do what? Why didn't Abu Nawas not leave? Because for him, Islam was not simply rituals, doctrines, and practices. It was part of a civilization with which he identified as a human being. To be a Muslim was to be part of a civilization, including its plausibility structure. And when the doctrines and the practices didn't hold people in, the plausibility structure would. Because the plausibility structure is what maintained the value, the status, the prestige of the teachings and the practices. And people wanted to identify with all of this. And Abu Nawas ended up near the end of his life writing poems about what? Religion. That's what actually happened. And so what we have to understand, we tend now to think of Islam as having been established by Malik and Abu Hanifa and all of the religious scholars. But that's not what made Islam the civilization that it was. They played their role, a very important role. But Islam as a civilization, as a plausibility structure, included not only religious scholars, but poets and architects and fashion designers and scientists and philosophers, all of those things that are needed to make up a civilization. And what those of you in this room have to understand is that you may not be a religious scholar, but you have a role to play in reestablishing the plausibility structure of Islam. We need poets, we need architects, we need fashion designers, we need interior decorators, we need business people, we need all of the things that go into a plausibility structure that would highlight the value, the prestige, and the profundity of the teachings of Islam. That's what we need. And until we get that, as long as the prevailing plausibility structure or ecosystem remains in place, Islam is going to continue, like Judaism and Christianity, to atrophy. It's going to continue to hemorrhage. We must understand that we have a civilizational role to play here. Now, in terms of the actual social-cultural context that has come to constitute the modern sort of ecosystem in which we all live. This is a huge topic, but I want to just talk about three elements of sort of the modern ecosystem in which we all live. And those three elements are the following. One is liberalism. Two is secularism. And three is scientism. All three of these are part of the ecosystem When you go to grade school today, all the way up through college, you are educated and socialized in such a way that these three entities become a part of your being. They become the part of the prism through which you see life. You internalize them. And in fact, those of us who are more successful in life, the more prestigious the school we send our children to, the more powerfully concentrated these entities tend to be. And what we're facing is that we are getting socialized, educated, determined by liberalism, secularism, and scientism, and then turning around and trying to make sense of Islam. That's like trying to see this as what? That's like trying to see this as what? As a nine. That's what that's like. So let's talk about these three for just a few minutes so that we might get some sense of how we might engage upon a project that will restore Islam's plausibility structure and its ecosystem. And here I want to be very clear about something. We Muslims have got to get out of the habit of being so short-sighted. We tend all the time to think about problem solving in very short increments. If we're talking about the restoration of Islam's plausibility structure, of an ecosystem in which Islam can thrive, we're talking about a transgenerational project. Something that we have to be in for the long term. We need to understand that, because we're not talking about just establishing something that's a flash in the pan that will deal with certain little pop-up problems and then disappear. We're talking about something that has some permanence. All right, so let me talk about the first element, liberalism. And here I want to be very careful on two levels. First of all, when I say liberalism, I'm not talking about liberals and conservatives. I'm not talking about political liberalism. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about liberalism as a philosophical ideal. All right? And that ideal includes lots of things, but the three main things that it includes is the following. Liberalism is based on the value of liberty. And it then privileges the following. One, autonomy. Two, individualism. And three, public reason. Now, what does that mean? Autonomy literally means autonomos. It literally means self-law. When I am autonomous, that means I do not recognize any law outside myself. Autonomos, self-law. I am the one who determines how I live. I do not recognize any authority outside myself that has the authority to tell me how to live. Two, individualism. What's important is not how the community or the family or the group is doing. What's important is how me as an individual is doing. What we are looking for is maximum individual freedom. And that freedom cannot be sacrificed for anything beyond the choice of individuals. And liberal society believes that if you just leave people to be free to choose what they want to do, then society will somehow, it will find its equilibrium and it will be a good society. Right? The last thing is Public reason. Public reason says that when we come into society, we all come from different backgrounds, different religions, etc. So, in order to keep us from falling into conflict, I can't use any arguments from my own religion in public space. Why? Because you don't believe in my religion. So if I come arguing on the basis of Quran and you're not a Muslim, right? There's nothing for you to discuss with me. And therefore, we might end up in conflict, maybe even bloodshed. So what public reason says is this. No one can use their own specific religious teachings in the public square. We all have to put those aside, and we can only argue on the basis of reasons that we all share, regardless of our religious background or any other background. Okay? And in that way, whatever we agree upon, it's agreed upon by us all. What public reason seeks to do is to come up with quote-unquote neutral justifications for how we structure society. And this is why arguments that are made on the basis of things like equality are so powerful. Why? Who differs on the value of equality? Who differs on the value of freedom? Okay? Now, what we have to imagine is this. How can I reconcile being a Muslim with the idea that no one outside myself has a right to tell me what to do? As a Muslim, I believe what? That God has a right to tell me what to do. And why do I believe that? Because my fundamental premise is that my life, my very existence, my very being is a gift. And I have a debt of gratitude to the one who gifted me life. And because of that, he has the right to tell me how he would like that gift that he has given me to be used. How do we reconcile that, however, with a notion that says, nobody outside me has to tell me or can tell me how to live? Liberalism says that the fact that I choose it, period, choice is sacred. The fact that I choose it is enough to validate it. And what we have to understand is that we are all being socialized about this. This is one of the reasons, and I hope you'll indulge me here. You know, one of the things that I have discovered over the years as I've traveled across the country, and in fact, even the world, is I can't tell you the number of particularly young Muslims that I've met who identify as Muslims. And some of them identify even as practicing Muslims. But when you get into, you know, a conversation with them, it's not long before you discover they are scared to death of their own religion. They are scared to death of their own religion. Because they see their own religion as nothing but constraint and an encroachment upon their autonomy. Because they've been socialized to place autonomy in the top spot. And everything else has to be reconciled with that. Now, as Muslims, in fact, even as religious people, we have to be honest about something. Liberalism didn't just come out of the woodworks. Liberalism was a response to religion. And this is one of the things, I mean, Sheikh Yasha touched upon it. When religion is done badly, society will respond by trying to come up with alternatives to religion. When people are given the sense that to be religious is to be miserable, to be religious, as Imam Sahib Webb was saying, you can't smile. To be religious, you cannot live fully. People will then look to alternatives to religion. That is a fact. Liberalism came about because religion would not allow people to live fully. And one of the things that we need to understand about Islam is that Islam is fundamentally about allowing people, in fact, empowering people to live both fully and righteously. Fully and righteously. Not just righteously. This is the problem. Not just righteously. Righteously and fully. We know man comes to the Prophet and says, what? I'm going to pray all night, not sleep. I'm going to fast every day. I'm not going to marry. What did the Prophet tell him, alayhi salam? You're not of me. I pray some in the night, I sleep. I fast some days, I don't fast some days. And I marry. The Prophet was living what? Righteously and what? And fully. The problem that we have now is that when people think of freedom, when people think of liberty, they can only think of it in liberal terms. Why? Because religion has failed to put forth a believable, empowering understanding of freedom. People see a contradiction between religion and freedom. And in the modern world, people want to be what? People want to be free. Let me share with you, this is part of what we have to do. We have to show that Islam not only supports, but empowers us to be free on an individual and a communal basis. Just an example, because I'm running out of time. You know, the companion Hudhaifa ibn al-Yaman, he married a Jewish woman. And it's reported that Umar came to him once and said, Hudhaifa, I heard you married a Jewish woman. Hudhaifa's first response was this. Ataqulu innahu haram? Are you saying that this is haram? What is Hudhaifa saying? I am free to exercise my choices within the parameters that God has set, and that you, Amir al-Mu'mineen, or anyone else has the right to deny me that freedom. I have a freedom that comes from God, and nobody can deny me that. And one of the challenges that we have as a religious community, as a Muslim community, we've got to give people back the freedom that God has given them. In the name of all kinds of things, we take people's freedom away from them unjustly, and then wonder why they then find difficulty being a Muslim. By the way, this is not simply, freedom on the individual level or just freedom for Muslims. Freedom for non-Muslims as well. And I'm going to share with you something that I hope won't be misunderstood. Islam, unlike the popular perception, and tragically, this is even the popular perception among many Muslims, Islam has no problem recognizing that non-Muslims are free to practice their religion and their way of life according to the way that their religion defines it. Islam has no problem with that. And let me read something to you from the Mudawwana of Sahnoun. Sahnoun was a Maliki scholar in North Africa, and he went to Ibn Qasim, who studied with Malik in Medina for about 20 years, and got Malik's teachings from Ibn al-Qasim. And Sahnoun would ask Ibn al-Qasim, he'd say, what do you say about so-and-so? And Ibn al-Qasim would say, Malik said X, or Malik said Y. Sometimes Ibn al-Qasim would say, I didn't hear this from Malik, but this is my opinion. All right? Now, Ibn al-Qasim died in the year 198 Hijri. That's over what? 1,200 years ago. 1,200 years ago. I want you to listen to what it said. Qultu. Who's that? I said, who is that? That's Sahnun. Qultu. Ara'ayta ahli dhimma. Iza kanu yasihilluna fi dinihim. Nikah al-ummahati wal-akhwati wa banat al-akh. Atukhallihim wa dhalika? Qala Ibn al-Qasim. لا يعرض لهم في دينهم وما هم على ما عهدوا عليه فلا يمنعوا من ذلك إذا كان ذلك مما يستحيلون في دينهم. I asked Ibn al-Qasim about these non-Muslim religious minorities among us. According to whose religion is permissible to marry your mother or your sister or your niece? What do you say about this? Ibn al-Qasim says, he asked them, do you allow them to do this? Ibn al-Qasim says, my view is that we do not intervene when they practice anything that their religion has made permissible for them to practice. We don't intervene and we allow them to practice according to what their religion says. How much more freedom do you want? Islam doesn't know freedom on the individual level, for Muslims, for non-Muslims. This is 1,200 years ago. Part of the reason that liberalism is so popular, so powerful, and so pervasive is that no one thinks that there's any alternative to liberalism in order for people to have any freedom. And this is a part of the ecosphere, the ecosystem that we now all live in. I want to move on very quickly to secularism, because the other two are secularism and scientism. And I promised I would be a good boy today and end on my time. But secularism is really quite easily. Secularism is basically the idea that we want to separate religion, or certainly the religious establishment, from society and or the state. That religion and the state must be separate. And as I tried to articulate last night, again, one of the reasons for this is that people think that religion dictates all kinds of things that it doesn't dictate. And for that reason, they want to separate it, because if they don't separate it out, it will dictate everything. Well, Islam, Sharia, does not dictate everything. Why did secularism not emerge in the lands of Islam? Why did it not emerge in the lands of Islam? Because there was no need for it. Because Islam always recognized there are things that relate to deen and there are things that relate to dunya. And for things that are related to deen, there are sources, and for things that are related to dunya, there are other sources, such as our minds, our experience, science, all kinds of things. There's no need to separate religion from the state, because religion is not trying to dictate everything. And unfortunately, we Muslims have been the last ones to articulate this, first to ourselves and then to society at large. Moving on then with my last couple of minutes to scientism. Scientism is a problem because it does two things. First of all, as I said, and Dr. Omar talked about this yesterday, scientism basically denies everything beyond the physical world. There is no mystery in existence. There is no human soul. There is no hereafter. There's nothing miraculous about us. There's nothing miraculous about this creation. And that leads to two things. One, my life is not a gift. It's an accident. Just biological things coming together. It's an accident. As a result, what do I have to be thankful for? And whom do I have to thank for? Scientific atheism undermines religion fundamentally, because it undermines the idea that this creation, including us, is a gift. Second, it undermines religious ritual. There's no soul to purify, because I don't have one. I'm just a bunch of chemicals, etc. This is part of the ecosystem in which we live, in which our children are socializing and have to try to make sense of Islam in the context of that. We Muslims have to address this ecosystem, and we will not survive. We will not thrive. We will not be able to transgenerationally sustain ourselves if we don't get back to an understanding of Islam, not just as a religion, but as a religion and its plausibility structure as a civilization. Jazakum Allah khair. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Thank you very much, Dr. Jackson. I must confess that every